From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up at Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Just days after the European Union voted overwhelmingly to finalize Britain's divorce, the architect of the Brexit plan, Nigel Farage, is attending President Donald Trump's State of the Union address this week. The Brexit referendum and Trump's election in 2016 took place just weeks apart, and the two remain linked as right-wing nationalist forces in both the US and UK celebrate their ongoing victories. With Brexit to formally take effect soon, what will trade relations between the UK and US look like? And what sort of relationship with the UK maintain with the European Union? My guest is Luke Reeder. He teaches in the Department of History at Case Western University in Cleveland, Ohio, and he's been closely following the developments. Welcome to the program, Luke.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Let's first talk about the actual vote that took place last week in the European Parliament. It apparently was quite an emotional affair, and the EU voted overwhelmingly to approve the resolution that Boris Johnson had essentially put forward. Can you explain to us exactly what it was that the EU voted on?
Essentially, they're voting on the terms of the withdrawal agreement, so the agreement that the UK and the EU struck to move to the next stage of Brexit. And that's, I think, something important to remember, which is that Brexit isn't actually over yet. Britain's formally left the EU, but there's at least another year in which negotiations will be ongoing and the two entities will decide their future relationship. And so the vote was basically to move to sort of officially move forward to that next stage.
And so trade relations will maintain for about a year, at which point there will presumably be a new sort of trade agreement to replace it?
Right, that's correct. As of right now, the trade relations are exactly the same as they were on the 30th of January, or even the 31st. Britain's still a member of the single market. Goods and services flow between Britain and Europe. The one difference is that as the year progresses, Britain will be shut out of decisions made in Europe about, could be regulations, could be standards, it could be anything to do with how sort of services are structured, how services are delivered, how services move between countries. Britain will no longer be a part of those discussions because it's no longer a member of the European Union. So for the first year, Britain is basically accepting EU rules, but it's no longer a member of the European Union. After 31st of December 2020, we don't know yet what the trade relations will look like.
So what has to happen now in Britain? Does the Parliament still have to vote on it?
Parliament doesn't have to vote because Parliament has to sort of decide it doesn't have to vote on leaving the European Union, but it has to vote on what the future relations will look like. It has to reach an agreement. Boris Johnson's government will have to reach an agreement, and then Parliament itself will have to agree to the terms that the government decides, or that the government and the European Union decide together. And Boris Johnson is in quite a difficult place because he's got multiple different constituencies he needs to please, none of whom sort of want exactly the same things. So much more free market sort of libertarians want, they want to sort of demolish what they see as sort of bureaucracy and red tape associated with the European Union. But quite a few of them would like a close relationship with the single market. People are very sort of concerned about sovereignty. They would like sort of very strict regulations on immigration, sort of protectionist sort of economy being or protectionist barriers being erected against trade. And they're sort of traditional Eurosceptic groups. But there's a third group, a sort of large number of people who really took Brexit over the top back in 2016, many of whom are actually former Labour voters. And their desire is sort of much more incoherent. They want sort of Brexit to get on with, and they want Instead, the government start concentrating on investing in declining industrial areas, putting that promise £350 million a week that Britain supposedly gave the European Union, directing it towards the National Health Service instead. And so Boris Johnson and his government have to juggle these three different constituencies, which makes his job harder.
So isn't this, however, still a major victory for Boris Johnson? I mean, if you look at it just on the surface, he promised to get Brexit done, and it looks like he achieved it, even if the terms of future relations are still to be determined.
Yeah, absolutely. Whether you like him or not, I think you have to agree he was last year's political winner. He became prime minister. He saw through Brexit, a project he's worked on intermittently for decades. He has a whopping great big majority in parliament. It's the largest majority of parties had since, basically since the turn of the millennium. So yeah, he's victorious. He's what's left to decide is what type of Brexit Britain will have. But the fact is, Brexit has occurred, and that is a victory for Boris Johnson.
What was the, as far as you know, the atmosphere like in Britain when the EU conducted its vote? The government, I understand, is attempting to not appear as though it's gloating because the country remains deeply divided. About 48 to 50% wished the UK could have remained in the EU. But did the pro-Brexiteers celebrate in full force?
I mean, there were small celebrations in, you know, in London and other cities, but really it was actually quite somber. I mean, I think one thing from what I've seen from over there that's quite surprising is the extent to which it sort of gradually sort of drifted off people's radars. You know, it may be discussed.
There's a lot of fatigue set in, I understand.
Exactly. Yeah, and the fact that the government's majority is so large. It's, you know, majority of 80 seats, which essentially means it has sort of reign to do as it wishes. And so, you know, by the third morning of the 13th of December, the day after last year's general election, effectively Brexit was done. It was sort of counting down those last 5 or 6 weeks until Britain left the EU. So I think it's sort of more somber, sort of more sort of dealing with sort of addressing the next steps. You know, I think many people probably feel, would probably feel a sense of relief. You know, even you're sort of very pro remaining in the EU people, you don't see much momentum in campaigning to sort of rejoin the European Union on that side either. You know, there's nobody saying, well, let's go right back in. There's a lot of sort of debate about, well, we need to take some time. We need to look at what worked, what didn't work, how do we make our case properly, how do we learn from the failures of 2016. Similarly, if you're Boris Johnson, you do need to deal with the fact that you need to unify a country which is divided, and in the last election, about 53% of people voted for parties that wish to either stay in the EU or have a much closer relationship with the EU than the government's currently intending.
On the day in which it happened, or the day after, I understand, there was one incident, one news report about a letter posted in a residential area called Winchester Towers entitled Happy Brexit Day, that was essentially filled with the sort of racist rhetoric that many people feared would become unleashed once Brexit went through, just given the sort of anti-immigrant basis for the Brexit folks. You know, the letter said in part, we are now our own country again, and the Queen's English is the spoken tongue here. If you do want to speak whatever is the mother tongue of the country you came from, then we suggest you return to that place and return your flat to the council so they can let British people live here and we can return to what was normality before you infected this once great island. It's a simple choice. Obey the rule of the majority or leave. I have to note that the Queen's English was missing a little bit of grammar. But I don't know, Luke, if you think that this was sort of an isolated incident, or is this the kind of thing you worry will happen more and more?
I mean, I think it's more sort of an example of things that sort of continue to rumble on more than anything else. That sort of badly spelled, grammatically incorrect sort of statement sort of existed before Brexit. It will exist after. It's awful for the people who receive them. I think, you know, you may see an upsurge in these sorts of statements, but you also see sort of other things. So you've actually seen sort of growing tolerance towards immigrants in a lot of polling since 2016. And so at the same time as you see sort of more of these incidents, you also see sort of gradually increasing tolerance, but maybe people thinking more about sort of the consequences of their actions and their statements. But I think it is an example of the type of scapegoating that could become prevalent if the economic fallout from Brexit in particular becomes damaging or becomes a drag on the British economy. So I think, I don't know if one letter itself necessarily sort of demonstrates a trend, but it demonstrates a good example of the types of things you could see, particularly if sort of Britain's bogged down in negotiations, if it's dragging on, if the sort of right-wing press, as they've often done, begins sort of demonize against immigrant groups, minority groups, that kind of thing.
Let's talk about the US and UK. The Trump administration has been very interested in the whole Brexit drama. President Trump claimed he knew exactly what to do when Theresa May was prime minister and was angry that she didn't take his advice. He's been a fan of Boris Johnson. And I mentioned Nigel Farage, who was the architect of the Brexit plan, is attending the State of the Union address. And a big fear among those who were critical of Brexit was that the US was interested in privatizing the National Health Service and wasn't going to be engaged in trade deals that were going to be bad for the British public. What do you anticipate for a US-UK trade deal? Could the NHS really be at stake?
I think the NHS as a sort of provider of health services, you know, those, you know, I don't think you'd be sort of having Anthem Blue Cross going in and buying up sort of hospitals across the UK. I think what you will see is US pharmaceutical companies trying to get access to the NHS, which is the NHS is the largest single payer system in the world. It's a massive drug buyer, and its sheer size means it has a great advantage in negotiating prices for drugs. You're going to see a huge amount of pressure put on the NHS and the government to increase the price of drugs, prescription drugs. It could be all sorts of pharmaceuticals. It could be new medications, that kind of thing. So I think that's where you'll see the pressure. You'll see the pressure there. You'll see it on the regulatory regime, which sort of structures you know, what sort of drugs get let into the UK market. It structures some of the sort of pricing mechanisms as well. And that, I think, is where the sort of greatest tension with the NHS. So the sort of costs will rise. Costs may rise there, which some people wouldn't see a consequence because some people don't pay for prescriptions. Other people will because, you know, about half the country does pay for prescriptions for various reasons. So yeah, that's where the sort of greatest pressure. At the same time, pharmaceuticals is also a huge industry in the UK, and so you know, there's going to be a sort of great amount of pressure put on the government by UK pharmaceuticals not to let the US sort of have access. So for every piece of pressure that comes from America, there's going to be subsequent pressure from UK equivalents as well.
Will this, you think, just potentially be part of what might be negotiated in a larger trade deal between the US and UK? Or since the UK is now sort of technically free of the EU, the pharmaceutical industry there is up for grabs, or the market there is up for grabs?
I think it would probably be you know, I can't imagine they would be interested in much more than sort of pharmaceutical drugs or giving, I could imagine sort of theoretically private US companies sort of participating in the UK private healthcare market. There is a system of private healthcare in the UK as well. Only about 7 or 8% of people use it, but there is a very small system there, which sort of uses NHS facilities. But I think the real crux of the trade deal is that there's actually not a lot to trade. Britain and the US do a lot of trade, you know, trade a lot with one another anyway. The UK is the largest foreign direct investor in the US, either the largest normally each year or the second largest. The US is a huge investor in the US, in the UK rather. And I think when people in the UK are sort of thinking about a trade deal, and I think probably in the US too, they're imagining sort of, I often think they're imagining people in the UK sort of all of a sudden driving Chevrolets, Volkswagens or Renaults. And, you know, there's just not the market or the sort of scope for that, given the way our respective economies work with just-in-time manufacturing, with sort of is a lot closer than the US.
So let's talk about some other aspects of the Brexit saga, and that is one of them, which is quite critical, is what could happen with Scotland. The Scottish National Party, which is the ruling party in Scotland, is a left-leaning party that made it very clear that it was in favor of Remain. And I understand that there may be a new independence referendum now. Could an unintended consequence of Brexit be if Scotland as a new independent nation sometime in the future?
Yeah, that certainly could be an unintended consequence. There is sort of gathering pace amongst the Scottish government for and Scotland has its own devolved parliament. There is sort of gathering pace with the SNP, the Scottish Nationalist administration there for another referendum. The problem for the SNP is that the route to a referendum runs through Westminster, which won't allow one because the previous referendum was sort of a once in a generation. Now, the SNP argue that Britain leaving the European Union kind of changes the terms of the deal that was negotiated. The UK government's currently arguing that it doesn't matter what the UK government does. The Scottish people signed up to follow the UK government when they voted no in their independence referendum in 2014. And so there's currently a sort of, you know, there's currently really a stalemate. The Scottish government wants a referendum. The UK government doesn't. I think what will be critical is what the results of the next Scottish elections are, which I think are due next year.
I see. So this whole independence referendum could be put off, at least until then. The current leader of the Scottish National Party, Nicola Sturgeon, is she someone who remains popular?
She does remain popular, both in Scotland. And she's actually widely respected across the UK as a whole, as a fairly effective politician. I think it's something that you're going to see the government in Scotland use as an instrument to sort of beat the UK government with whenever there's a sort of problem with Brexit. You're going to see the Scottish government return to independence as a sort of rhetorical tool. And I think that actually in many respects is the smartest strategy is to, you know, they also have their different factions to appease. And so calling for a referendum will appease the sort of more extreme nationalists. Playing a sort of long game will keep the sort of more pragmatically minded nationalists happy, in the sense that the longer they criticize the UK government, much as the UK did with the EU, the more they will turn opinion in Scotland against being sort of part of the United Kingdom and what could have been a narrow loss. You know, if you could imagine a sort of referendum next year, it might result in a very narrow loss. Then sort of sidelining the question for decades, as occurred in Quebec about 25 years ago. if you imagine they wait a few years, you might be able to get a sort of much more sort of decisive result. And so it's also a question of whether they're sort of thinking long term or they're sort of feeling pressured from their sort of grassroots supporters as well.
And then there's the case of Ireland. What is the ramification of the Brexit deal in Ireland? Irish Prime Minister Leo Varadkar is not very happy with the post-Brexit proposal of the Boris Johnson government. What's happening there?
Right. Well, you know, that's, you know, in many respects, that's the, you know, that's the more sort of pressing question. Scotland's a sort of pressing constitutional question. Northern Ireland is a much more pressing question because, you know, we're just 22 years out from the end of the Troubles, the sort of 30 years of terrorism associated with Northern Ireland. Right. So we have a still fragile peace that in many respects was upheld by the European Union. Now, Boris Johnson had negotiated a deal with the EU, which essentially kept Northern Ireland inside the sort of EU customs zone to, you know, in order to prevent there being a hard border on the British-Irish border, and instead sort of placing this line, sort of, if you could imagine, sort of imaginary line running down the middle of the Irish Sea, that's effectively where the Irish-British border is placed. This places Northern Ireland in a sort of very odd sort of situation where it's constitutionally part of the UK, but it, in sort of economic terms, it's a different entity which isn't quite the UK and isn't quite the European Union either. It's very uncertain for the people living there. It's very uncertain for people living in the Republic of Ireland. Many people hate it because they fear that tensions could lead to a rise in violence. You've got the added complications of elections in the Republic of Ireland, which seem at the moment to be running a sort of three-way tie between the two major Irish parties and Sinn Féin. So we have sort of no idea what the government in the Republic of Ireland will look like, will want. You have unionists who support close links with the UK in Northern Ireland, upset, feeling that they've been sold out by the UK government. And you've got nationalists, whether sort of fervent nationalists or whether much more sort of moderate or pragmatic nationalists, wondering if this will be the sort of gradual sort of withering of ties between Britain and Northern Ireland. And so you have a lot of uncertainty and a lot of real effort to try and avoid any border being created. But there's the complication of, if you've got this imaginary line down the Irish Sea, well, how are you going to check goods that are coming across? Are you going to have a line of ships that sort of stop ships at this imaginary line? Are you going, you know, there's all these sort of questions that the EU needs to ask. Will this line be symbolic and goods will actually be checked on the border anyway? We know no details, like a lot of Brexit, and it's the uncertainty as much as anything else that is creating the concern. We just don't know what things will look like at the end of December 2020.
Well, finally, Luke, where does the current Brexit situation leave the Labour Party and the leadership of Jeremy Corbyn, which was so soundly defeated in the last election?
I mean, I think for Labour, they're, you know, I mean, obviously they're fighting a leadership battle right now. You've got the two main candidates, Rebecca Long-Bailey, who's sort of, she's seen as very closely associated with the Corbyn camp, who's always sort of very sceptical of the Brexit line of sort of having a second referendum, maybe sort of thinking again, she was more of a sort of, let's try and sort of get the best deal done. You've got Keir Starmer, who was the European spokesperson for the Labour Party, who was sort of pushing a sort of second referendum line. Now that Brexit's occurring, I think there's a consensus in the party for as close a relationship with the European Union as possible. However, whoever's leader of the Labour Party, this won't be anything they can enact until, you know, for at least 5 years, possibly 10, given the size of the Conservative Party majority. And so I think in regards to Brexit, what the Labour Party will be doing, I think, will be as if and when economic problems arise, sort of trying to make that connection back to Brexit, trying to sort of put pressure on the government, particularly with sort of soft government supporters who may have once voted for the Labour Party, and to try and sort of attach that to Brexit. And not to say let's rejoin the European Union, but to say, look, our economic future requires us to have closer ties with the EU and sort of make that case. Whether it will work is something that remains to be seen. Whether these voters are gettable is also something that remains to be seen. It's, in many respects, you're dealing with a party, much like the Democratic Party in the US, who's trying to sort of figure out how do you balance a younger, more diverse metropolitan coalition, maybe a highly educated metropolitan coalition, with a sort of white working class, smaller town, smaller city coalition. How do you sort of bridge these two divides? The Democratic Party's, well, we're seeing them grapple with it in Iowa right now. Labour Party's beginning to sort of come to terms with that as well.
Luke, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate your insight on this issue.
Thank you.
My guest has been Luke Reeder. He teaches in the Department of History at Case Western University in Cleveland, Ohio. We've been discussing Britain's post-Brexit future. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupatsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.